For members only, Golf Smarter number 280, published on April 26, 2011.
SmarterPodcasts.com. Delivering sound advice.
A golf course dedicated to charity, part two with Brady Wilson.
This is Golf Smarter, sharing tips and insights from golfers and golf professionals to help lower your score. It's worked for your host, Fred Green.
Welcome back to Golf Smarter for members only, Brady.
Oh, thank you for having me back, Fred. Sorry I was a little long-winded last time.
Oh, you know, last time it was just seconds ago. So we were talking about Rory McIlroy's meltdown, and in the post-game interview, one of the things that stood out to me that he said was, well, I knew Sunday was going to be tough when we started. And that kind of jumped out to me as if saying, I was beat before I even got started. I knew, you know, I mean, I wasn't approaching it as if I've got this thing in the bag. I'm going to play aggressively like I've been doing all week. I'm going to be a little more tentative. And am I off on that one? Did I miss it? Or what's your take on him saying that?
Well, maybe a little bit. I mean, I think there's so much made of the tournament doesn't start till the back nine on Sunday at Augusta. I mean, you've heard everybody say that so many times. And he had a lead going in, and everyone, you know, Norman had a lead going in. I mean, you know, but it's always, the Masters always seems to get tight down the line. And, that might be more of a comment towards, hey, listen, I knew it wasn't going to be easy. I knew I wasn't going to go out and just have a walk in the park and win the Masters. I knew there was going to be some people that were going to make a charge, and, you know, I knew I was going to have to play well to win and didn't. But, you know, there's definitely room to read there that there was some self-doubt, and clearly there was, you know. And again, I don't know, not having his coach there, I don't know, man. It's a different world now. I'm not a big fan of, like, you need a coach there all the time to just, you know, but, you know, if I'm Rory's golf pro in Ireland and he's playing the way he is, I'm getting on a plane, man. I'm going to be there.
Rory will pick up the tab, I'm sure.
I'm going to support him, you know what I mean? And kind of tying back to our last conversation, you know, I think that's a little bit that support that, you know, you don't have in the individual, you know, out on tour that you do have in college golf and at the Ryder Cup. I mean, I remember last year when Mahan kind of faltered down the end, and I think it was it Sink or Furyk that put their arm around him in the post game conference and said, you know, this, he handled himself like, it's, you know, I mean, they were picking him up, and, you know, Rory needed someone to pick him up, man. You know, it's just him and his caddy out there, but he'll be back. That kid is way too talented, way too good. And he'll be back. I hope he wins the Masters, to be honest with you. I really do.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, there's sometimes there's a moment in someone's professional sports career that is the turn for their career that they never get back to the top, you know, and people look back and go, yeah, well, that was number 10 on Sunday at the Masters was his, you know, just the beginning of the fall for him. So it could go either direction. Of course, we hope the best for the kid, you know, that he has a great career, but it's not as if he, you know, because he's been like, you know, who's going to take over for Tiger? Who's it? Well, it's going to be Rory McIlroy. You know, they've been talking about that for a couple of years, you know.
Yeah, I mean, and I guess that's what I would say is different. You know, with Norman's collapse, you kind of felt like maybe that was, you know, he's getting towards the end of a legitimate opportunity. You know, I mean, that maybe that was the last time that he really could be, you know, maybe that was his last shot at it, you know. And, you know, especially a couple of years ago at the British Open that he was competitive in, and Tom Watson at the British Open, you know, when those guys don't come through like that, you just go, God, you know, how many opportunities really are they going to have? I mean, how many more opportunities is Tom Watson going to have to win a major? you know what I mean?
But he has won. I mean, Watson has been on top of the world.
That's a good point too. But I mean, you feel like Rory's got enough of a future that he'll be back. You know, I know he hasn't won one yet, but
yeah. Well, how long did we
wait? Very good connection there.
But. Yeah. How long did we wait for Phil to win a major? Right. We were always like, is he ever going to get there?
Yeah.
And he did. And now it's like, is he done? You know?
Right.
Are we sure? It's so interesting to talk about the tour this way. And you know, they do it nonstop on Golf Channel. And you know, I was actually reading in the paper this morning, and they were almost comparing it to Jason Gore, who, you know, they called a journeyman. And they, in 2005, when he had his, you know, his collapse, he won a couple times, but he's still out on the nationwide tour now, struggling to get back on the main tour.
Yeah.
But that's what we love about golf, I think. It's that train wreck element that we were talking about earlier, that we love about golf. It's like, can he hold on? You know, there is no way to predict what's going to happen.
Dustin Johnson last year was a little different, kind of a train wreck.
Oh my gosh!
Yeah. But he had one. He had the train wreck at U.S. Open.
Right at Pebble Beach, right?
Know. Yeah.
Yeah, and that was on Sunday as well.
And then he had the train wreck ruling.
Whoa! Right. So. Which was if it's sand, it's a bunker.
Yeah. Right.
Really? Oh my gosh!
Yeah,
and talk about and I do thank you for all that input. And it's interesting, you know. Again, young players, and the emotional IQ,
right?
And you know, maturing. You know, again, I still don't know if I have an answer. Not only just from you, but from a lot of people I've asked, is can these young kids who don't have the emotional maturity, not only emotional IQ, but the maturity to carry them through to make them a smarter player in the long run, that you know, that maturity that you gain as you get older and you get into more situations and, you know, act like you've been there. You, as you talk about being a basketball coach, you know, you act like you were there before. Don't make it a big deal.
Right. Right. I think you can. I mean, I think it comes a little bit with experience. I mean, there's,
right.
we always talk about the kid that's wise beyond his years and mature beyond his years. And that, you know, that's what you're looking for. You know, and I think, yeah, you definitely can learn that stuff. You know, I think, you know, but you gotta want to be in control of your emotions. You know what I mean? You gotta want it. You know, if you just are going to play emotionally, you're going to be up a lot and down a lot.
Right, and that brings us back to getting into a college program, and what they're looking for is yeah. your maturity.
Right. Yeah, you know, I mean, technical golf swings and scores and stuff also play a factor, obviously, for a college coach. They want to put the best team that they can. But you know what? If you're a college coach and you have, you know, five or six or seven really solid players that are very emotionally stable and secure, you know what? You're not going to have to worry about them outside the golf course, outside the classroom as much, and they're going to continue to improve, right? Mm-hmm. Because you got them for 4 years. So, you know, I think that's definitely a thing that college golf coaches look for.
Sure, unlike college football coaches would have to worry about their kids getting themselves in trouble with the law. So many football programs that have, you know, kids that don't have that kind of that maturity. So how many kids are on a college golf program at any given time on the varsity level?
Well, you know, the college golf, they play five and count four in every tournament. So there's anywhere between, you know, 8 to 11, I would say, depending on, you know, just how you're going to structure your scholarship situation or whatever. I think that's probably a little bit up to the individual coaches. You know, 8 might be a little bit light, actually, you know, at the higher levels. But, you know, they're going to, you know, I was number 9 or 10 at Fort Lewis. So I was a long way from the varsity five, but, you know, it was, you know, you're still there practicing. You still go through qualifying. You know, you're still trying to compete. So, you know, it kind of depends on the coach and how he wants to set up his program. Some guys like a lot of players so that there's a lot of competition. Some people just want to get 5 or 6 or 7 really good guys and just go as far as they can with them. So, you know, and you also got, you know, different universities have different scholarships and, you know, equivalencies and dollars to spend and budgets for recruiting. So, I mean, that's all going to play a factor in that. But, yeah, usually you're a roster between, let's say, 9 and 12.
Yeah, so then you're not going to see a lot of scholarships handed out on a yearly basis. New scholarships, right?
No, I don't think so. And I mean, you know, I know a lot of coaches like to take their scholarships and split them up, you know, and try to get, you know, I don't know how many kids are going to go, you know, depending on how many you got, full rides or whatever, you know. I mean, is it better to get, you know, take one scholarship and get two kids that you can get, or spend it all on one? How many do you have, you know, divided up? How you see? So it's up to each coach, and you know, every year changes for those coaches too. I mean, you know, you might have a year where you go really heavy on a young group. You know, we've all seen that. You know, we had the 5-5 in basketball. Well, you know, I mean, there's not a lot of scholarships coming in after them for a couple of years. You know,
right,
what I mean,
right?
And that's kind of the same thing with golf. I mean, if you get a really heavy freshman class, you know, you get three or four players out of a freshman class, and you're really heavily invested in them financially, you know, you're not going to have a lot coming up for the next couple of years. So it's all very secular, you know. That's coaches manage that. You know, that's their job, is to manage that. So,
right. So I guess the message to parents of young golfers is, don't make plans to get a scholarship for golf. Don't think that your kid's a good golfer and there's scholarship money. It's going to help you through the college. The chances are very slim that's actually going to happen.
There's not a lot of dollars out there. There are dollars out there. There are scholarships, you know, but there's, you know, you're going to get out of it what you put into it, though, you know.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, and you know, I will say this. College women's golf has come a long way. I mean, it used to be just because the participation was thinner in junior golf. You know, there's less, you know, there was, you know, it used to be, you know, an equivalency, you know, in Title IX, you know, most
I'm glad you
universities
brought it up.
That have, most universities that have two, both a men's and women's program, they need those programs to be equivalent.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm running a men's program and you're running a women's program, you know, there's, you know, let's just be honest, there's more high school golfers for me to choose from as a men's program than there are for you as a women's program. So, you know, where's the talent pool? You know, and you know, it used to be, you know, guys, you break 80, you can play Division I golf and you get it paid for. But you know, I think that's gotten better. I think there's more women playing the game, more girls in junior golf programs, more high school golf teams. I mean, I remember a time when, you know, my high school didn't have a high school golf team when I went there, and my younger sister started it when she got up to high school. So, you know, now there's, you know, most high schools have to, you know, have a women's golf, a girls' golf program along with their boys. So, you know, I think there's more opportunity. I think there's better players now with the lady golfers, and so I think you're seeing more opportunities for college women's golf too, and that's really important and good for our game.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you brought up Title IX, because I know there's a lot of, you know, we talked about wrestling earlier, you know, collegiate wrestling, is that a lot of college wrestling programs have been eliminated because it's mostly men, or not all men. So they, because of Title IX, they can't support it anymore.
Well, it's just total numbers in the universities. You know, I mean, football is hard to compete with because, you know, you got 115 participants.
So what are what's the equivalent on the women's side of football? How do they justify that?
Right. There's not. Lacrosse is popular because, you know, you got to have a pretty, you know, lacrosse and soccer, both, you know, you're going to have over 20. So, you know, that helps, you know. But, yeah, holy cow. There's no equivalent to football. And,
really,
and wrestling's kind of – and wrestling, correct me if I'm wrong, but you're usually looking at 20 to 25 for a team on wrestling. Am I right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's – you know, I mean, that's a tough number to match up on the other side too. So, and
right.
Then and Title IX is so complicated. There's so many different aspects to it. There's so many different compliance measures. They're not all just related on total number of student athletes, you know, student, you know, budgets and coaches' pay and equivalency is really what it's all about. And there's so many different aspects to it that, you know, I kind of am out of touch with it a little bit since I've gotten out of coaching college women's basketball. But, you know, we were, you know, there's a lot of different aspects to it. It's probably one of the more misunderstood things out there. It's not just about having equal opportunity for both men and women. That's its goal, but it's not just down to numbers. It's not just, well, you got football, so now you got a whole bunch of women's programs to counteract it. That's not necessarily how it works, but it's just about providing an environment of equal opportunity and making sure that, you know, your men's basketball program is not more funded or, you know, from a scholarship standpoint than your women's program. You know, you need those to be similar. They need to be matching up, you know, those type of things. So, yeah, it's just, it's, you know, but definitely it provides opportunities for women college athletes, which is very important to do. And I think it's helped out women's golf. I really do.
Yeah, no doubt. It's helped women's basketball.
Yes.
But not women's football.
No.
That's something that's not going to be on TV all too soon. Or support a university itself, you know, like men's football supports a university. No wonder they make different rules for it, just like the USGA makes different rules for everybody else. And that was, you know, did you catch that rule that they changed just before the Masters? The USGA made that rule change about signing the scorecard issue. Did you catch that one?
No, I did not.
Oh, they made a change in the ruling that week ahead of it that if you signed your scorecard and there was an error on it, you know, you didn't count a stroke or something because you made a mistake, you've been disqualified, right?
Right.
Now it's a two-stroke penalty. You're not disqualified anymore.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
I hadn't heard that.
I read it. I was like, how come no one's talking about this? I read it. They're like, yeah, by the way.
With all the rules of golf, there are, that's the one that they wanted to change.
Well, it would have saved Dustin. Yeah, it would have saved Dustin Johnson, right?
But at least it moves things in the right direction for the player, you know, protecting the player a little bit. So that's good.
Yeah, I've always thought that the USGA was an advocate for the golf course, not the golfer.
Yeah. Yeah, I still think that you should be able to move the ball out of a divot if you hit it in the fairway, but we'll see.
Good for you. Right on. I agree 100%. As a matter of fact,
It seems like that should be considered temporary ground under repair.
Oh, why not?
Right.
Yeah.
But that's my only. That's the one I would change.
Now, you're associated with a golf course that's had its own kind of controversy with the tour, correct?
Well, yeah, a little bit. I wouldn't say it's controversy. We hosted the Bob Hope Classic here in 2006, 2007, and 2008, and the golf course was built by our ownership group, the Berger Foundation, and then gifted to the Bob Hope Classic Charities, Desert Charities, which is basically the organization that runs the tournament out here for the Bob Hope. And, you know, so we were the host site. We were going to be the long-term host site. You know, we had a little bit of wind in 07. We made a lot of changes to the golf course per the tour recommendation. The players, the players enjoyed the golf course immensely. And then, you know, in 08, we had perfect weather, and the other venues had some wind. So, you know, the argument was, you know, if you catch the wrong course on the wrong day, you have no chance of winning the tournament. Kind of like getting the wrong pairing and wrong, you know, the wrong on Thursday, Friday, the wrong pairing of the British Open that's always a topic over there, but it's the British Open. It's not the Bob Hope. So, there was definitely a contingent of players that voiced some concern just about, hey, the different locations are kind of hard, you know. To a person that I talked to on the tour, they love the golf course. They love our facility. They'd love to play it more often. But, you know, for the Bob Hope, for the event, you know, we're further away than PGA West. We're kind of disjointed from them. So they've moved everything back over to PGA West in La Quinta. It's very centrally located. Everything's right next to each other. So we did not continue on hosting the Hope. And then our initial ownership group, the Berger Foundation, took back ownership of the golf course, and they've been very supportive. Obviously, you know, they hired Tune Golf to manage the property, and and the company that I work for, and we're very, you know, we've changed our dynamic here a little bit. We used to be a very high-end public daily fee golf course that charged a very large amount of money to play. We're still a little bit competitive, but we hold the facility for charitable purposes. So, you know, if you're a charitable, if you have a 501c3 designation and you're running a charitable tournament, you know, our kind of motto is we want to help charities help themselves. So you can run a golf tournament out here for a very affordable rate and help generate some money that's going to hopefully go to a good cause. And we do that. And we also have a local resident program that is kind of a, allows our local residents to play our golf course on a very short-term booking window for a very affordable fee, kind of similar to like what you might see at Bethpage or Torrey Pines, but a little different. So, you know, it's allowing that you know,
but
you
it's know, not a, it's not a muni course like Bethpage.
No, it's privately owned. So that
right.
that kind of resident program is not. It's completely subsidized by our ownership group, the Berger Foundation. It's not subsidized by any tax dollars, which Torrey Pines and Bethpage are. So
in 2006, 7, and 8, when the Classic Club was hosting the Bob Hope, were there, excuse my ignorance, but were there multiple courses that were hosting simultaneously? Were they playing on different courses?
The Bob Hope format is a 5-day tournament on 4 golf courses.
Oh.
Okay. And so, and you play, and the pros play with 3 different amateurs for 4 straight days. And then there's a cut made on Saturday. So it's not a Tuesday, it's not a Thursday, Friday cut, Saturday, Sunday finish. It's a Wednesday through Saturday, then cut, and then a Sunday finish. And then one of those 4 courses is the host site for the final day, which is just the pros. And it's, so the pros are going to play 2 rounds at Classic Club, and then they're going to play a round at the other 3 courses when we were the host site. So okay. we were
and
not
they play
only
on Sunday at the Classic Club?
Yeah, and they played on Sunday at the Classic Club in 06, 07, and 08. So we still have the Sunday hole locations, and we still use them for special tournaments.
Okay, so and when they make the cut at the end of Saturday, then the amateurs are done. So they're getting their – they get 4 rounds in, the amateurs playing with a pro, and then the pro – oh, interesting.
And it's amateurs are in 3-man teams, and then they rotate with the pro. So they play with 4 different pros in 4 different days. They play all 4 courses, then play with 4 different pros. But the amateurs stay the same.
Right.
So it's kind of a – it's a very unique format, you know, and the history of the Bob Hope, you know, it's been around for 51 years, and it's – you know, it was designed – it was back in the day. It was a great opportunity for struggling tour pros to come out and meet some, you know
– big rollers?
Yeah, there you go. The people that would support them and help them out. And so, you know, times have changed. You know, there's a lot of very, very, very – good tour players that are very great people that enjoy the pro-am format. There are some of them that don't enjoy that either. So, you know, it's
and what time of year is it generally held?
Late January, third week in January. It's right after they come back from Hawaii. So, you know, they open the season over at Kapalua, and then they play the Sony, and then they're here.
And does it also conflict with the Super Bowl? Or no, that would be the Phoenix Open.
Right, that's the Phoenix Open. No, it conflicts with the championship games.
Right, exactly. So that probably had an impact as well. But you're saying that some of the tour players were saying that they were not happy with hole locations?
No. The in 07, it was very windy.
And you can't
you know,
do anything
some
about
the,
that. And that's golf.
Some of the, yeah, and. You know, some of the hole locations on some of our greens were very, very difficult, and so we made some changes to the golf course in 07. We rebuilt 3 greens, took out some bunkers. We made changes to I think 13 of 18 holes, and those were all you know kind of tour recommendations. But you know, 08 rolled around and we had perfect weather, perfect over here. It was perfect for 5 straight days. But there was some weather over at the other courses, and so you know the you know where they felt on 07, they felt they caught Classic Club on a bad day. They had no chance of winning the tournament when they caught PGA West on a bad day on 08, they had no chance of winning the tournament, you know. So it's one of those things where if I'm playing here, which Classic Club's a hard golf course. We're 7,300 yards from the back tees, mm-hmm. okay? You know, it's not the average, you know, pitch and putt course. And you know, and the Bob Hope had played some fairly easier venues than ours, you know, in its history. But, you know, we're 75-8, 144 as a rating from the back tees.
I mean, 144?
Yeah, it's a pretty good golf course. You know, we do have five sets of tees, five sets of options, and so, you know, you can pick your playability level. You know, water comes into play out here quite a bit, and we have kind of an island green out on 12, and, you know, Arnold Palmer design, you know. So, I mean, it's a very, very good golf course. And obviously, I mean, I played yesterday in a fundraising event here at our facility. The wind came up. It was windy. And, yeah, it was windy. And it's a hard golf course when it's windy. But, you know, it's our valley gets wind.
Sure.
The Coachella Valley gets wind. It's windy everywhere. It was windy everywhere yesterday, you know, and not just at Classic Club. So, you know, it's just a mix, and that's kind of where the tour went, and they kind of wanted to keep everything more centrally located. And we are kind of out on our own, so we're kind of we didn't have three other golf courses around us that were worthy of hosting it. So they took it back to over to La Quinta and PGA West and that area, and you know, it's a very viable event. It's a good event. It's a, you know, what people don't probably know about that event is how much money that generates for charities and good causes. So, you know, it's a really good tour event to support, and they just picked up a new sponsor, Humana, for a while, so that's good. You know, they were without a sponsor. So, you know, things are really, you know, that tournament's going to stay on the schedule. It's going to survive, and it's a unique event. It's different than any other event they play all year, but you know, we wish it has a special place with all of us. We wish it the best of luck. We'd all love to have it, but it probably doesn't make sense anymore now with the property and the way that we hold the property now to host it. But it was a great experience, and the players loved the golf course. The golf course is really good. The golf course, and I'm not saying because I work here. I mean, the golf course is one of my favorite golf courses to play. It's in really good shape.
Well, it's managed by Troon, so yes.
Yeah, our director of agronomy, Jeff Sanders, does a phenomenal job keeping it in great condition. And it, like I said, it's a good test at 144 slope. I mean, if you hit good shots, you're rewarded. If you hit bad shots, you're penalized. And that's the way golf courses should be.
So. And if you're in a divot, you can move it.
At my course, you can.
It's your course right now.
yeah. In my rule book. So.
Well, you know, it's interesting because the way you describe it, it kind of sounds like, and I've witnessed families that are like this, that there's one of the cousins, I guess, that's ostracized from everybody else. And yet they're when you're an outsider looking at the family, that's the person that's the most generous, the most giving, the most charitable, you know, and it's like, well, why do they not, you know, let this person in? Why is he the black sheep? And he's the nicest guy of the group.
Yeah.
How many charitable events do you guys do? Because, you know, I've seen golf courses like they hold Monday for the charitable event, you know, or Friday.
Right.
But what do you guys try to do? That's really neat that you said you like promote the fact that you want charities to come there. That's unique.
Yeah. I mean, we are. Diane Plicta is our charitable sales and marketing manager. That's her title. So,
that's unique in itself. I don't think a lot of courses have someone that they have a special events person who wants to sign up weddings and, you know, and occasional charitable events. But you have someone dedicated to charitable events.
Yeah, in 2010 we did 5,474 tournament rounds. Okay, and of those, And we're going to do more than that this year.
Over 5,000?
You know, that's quite a bit of tournament rounds. So we went up in tournament rounds when a lot of people were going down. And that's, you know, we get a lot of groups that want to play here. Of those rounds, the ones that were for pure what we call pure charitable, were 2,660, somewhere in that ballpark. So you know, we were kind of at almost half or a little bit more than half were completely charitable rounds, where people were they were using it as a fundraiser to create money for a local charity. Okay, and if you to figure out what we charge them versus what our rack rate was during those times, the charitable donation part that we took off of those rounds was over $223,000. So, you know, now that's so the idea is we really are in the business of helping charities help themselves.
Awesome. Wow. Oh, when you say over 5,000 rounds, you're talking about 5,000 players, not 5,000 events.
Yes. Yeah. I'm talking
about
players.
How's that possible?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. All right.
No,
yeah.
No. If we did 5,000 events, I probably wouldn't be having time to, or any hair to talk to you. So, but yeah, no, those are rounds. So, I mean, we consider any group over 13 a group. So, you know,
okay.
But you know, so that's kind of the numbers for you. Just and they're going to be bigger and better this year. We're going to do more charitable rounds this year. The first quarter this year was just amazing how busy it was for our property, and you know, it's been a unique environment. I called the PGA of America when we decided to make this business model change and asked them if there's any others in that they know of. And my answer was no. We were the first ones. There's non-for-profit golf courses, but we're trying to hold the facility for actual charitable purposes. So it was it's been a great experience for myself. We've you know, it's kind of humbling to be able to go to work every day at a beautiful place, beautiful clubhouse, and kind of know you're making the world better. And I know that sounds corny, but that's kind of what we do here. It's, you know, we're given the tools by our ownership group, who are awesome, and have the support of Troon Golf, who's, you know, obviously got a great reputation in the industry, to do something that really no one else is doing, you know, and that's provide a tour caliber golf course at tour caliber conditions with premier service. Our golf team does a premier job with service.
Troon Golf.
And at a real affordable price, whether it's for a charity or for the resident program here, locals, to take care of them, or for the vacation golfer that wants to come in, they're going to pay 20% below the market average here to play golf. So, you know, I mean, when you start factoring all that in, usually when you see decline in fees, you see decline in service and conditions. But we've done the opposite. We've maintained those at a high level, yet still offered a great value to our golfers.
That's so awesome.
It's a special place.
Yeah.
If any of your listeners out there have not experienced it, you know, in our local in the Southern California area, they all means should make a trip out. You can visit our website at classicclubgolf.com and see pictures of the golf course, and we have flyovers of the holes. And I mean, it's we do a first class job here, and we're proud of that. And you know, we're happy to be, like I said, our ownership group. We couldn't do it without them. The Berger Foundation, they're unbelievable, unbelievable people. They're just quality people, and want to make the world a better place. And obviously, Troon Golf has been very supportive. And you know, it's not the typical business model that Troon Golf sees. So,
no.
You know, everyone at our corporate office at Troon Golf has been very cooperative and understanding and helping us out, and knowing that, you know, kind of like you said, we're the black sheep. We're a little different than everybody else. This golf course is a little different than your average golf course.
That's one of the interesting things about Troon Golf as well, is they like to have, what I've noticed, is they don't mind having a feather in their cap that is a different color than everybody else's feathers. You know, it's like, we do this, but we're the only one doing it, or we're the first ones to do it, and hopefully we're setting a standard for the, you know, a new standard. That's really interesting, because I know that down in San Diego, Coronado, you know, they're run by the Port of San Diego, and they don't have to make a profit. That's not what they're doing. So they're, you know, the rack rate is really low, and the course is, you know, it's in nice shape and it's a nice place if you have great weather. But to have the level of course that you have, and it be dedicated as a, you know, for charity, is amazing. And you're so lucky, because I was reading a book recently that was talking about how The perfect kind of job is one that not only do you get a lot from in the way of learning and positive reinforcement, but one that you can also feel like that you're giving back to your not only your customer base, but your community as well. And when you find that kind of balance, it's kind of like the perfect job because you really want to go to work.
Yeah, it's not easy. It's not hard to get out of bed every day. You know, I work at a golf course. I do most of the instruction here at the property. So, you know, I'm teaching people the game of golf. I'm seeing them getting better. We're doing business out of with a charitable mind. And you know, how can we help you? You know, we have a logo. We have a secondary logo. You know, that's the big thing, right, with all sports teams, right? You have your primary logo and a secondary logo. Mm-hmm. You know, our secondary logo says play to give underneath it. So,
nice.
You know, that's what we do here. And you know, it was a transition. You know, no doubt it was an adjustment period for our team. You know, they had to go from being a high-end, daily fee, for-profit facility that hosted a tour event that came with a lot of prestige to, you know, being a charitable venue that does a lot of tournament rounds and has a resident program. And I mean, that's an adjustment. That's not easy on your staff. You know,
Did that idea come from Troon down, or did you come from you guys and you had to sell it in and get Troon to buy the concept?
It came from our ownership group. Uh-huh. And that's what their vision for the property became when they took it back after the Hope left. And so, yeah, and that was, you know, we had to get on board with it, obviously. And we had to champion it. Yeah, yeah. Uh-huh. I mean, our local management team here, and you know, how's this going to work? And then obviously we had to talk to Trin about it and make sure that all the, you know, there's some I's and T's that needed to be dotted and crossed, you know, just, you know, restructuring contracts and different things. But it was real smooth and really quick and easy. And, you know, our ownership group couldn't be happier with Troon Golf. And I don't think they every year at the Troon Golf Management Conference, they announce the owner surveys. And in our owner survey was 100% this past year. So, you know,
congratulations.
So clearly that bodes well that our ownership group's happy with Troon Golf as well. And it's a marriage. It's a marriage made in heaven, I think, for everybody.
Well, I apologize if I'm making you walk any political tightropes here by asking these kind of questions. I feel you're like answering the question like going, I better not say something here. But I appreciate that you giving me the answer that you have. And it's really interesting to hear about a course like that. And, of course, for listeners, check the show notes. And I will make sure to put classicclubgolf.com on the show notes. And if you go to the website at golfsmarter.com, I'll put just a link on there. You just click on it so you can go check out the golf course. And if you're making any plans to head down to the Palm Springs area, Palm Desert, obviously, go play the course. It's going to be worth your while. And if you don't have plans to go to Palm Desert, make some. Make some, because you're going to love. Don't go to Florida. You don't have to go to Florida. It's humid. It's gross. There's hurricanes. No, go in the wintertime. Go down to Palm Desert. You'll see why people go, this is where I'm going to retire.
Yeah, there you go.
Absolutely. Hey, Brady, thanks so much for all your time, our recording time today, and that we were able to split it into two episodes. I really appreciate it because we have spent a lot of time together, but you had so much interesting information from the junior golf part all the way to a very special, unique golf course. Thanks so much for coming on.
No, thank you for having me. I appreciate the opportunity, Fred. Anytime.
You don't mind if I share a quick follow-up for right here, do you? I just returned from Palm Desert literally about a half hour ago, and the day that we got a chance to play the Classic Club, the winds were blowing at about 35 miles an hour. So really the only highlight that I want to report to you is that on number 17, right into the teeth of the wind, it was a par 3, 145-yard hole. So the other two guys had a 4-iron and then a 5-iron. Actually, the other way around, a 5-iron, then a 4-iron, and they both came up about 25, 30 yards short. So I pulled out the 3 hybrid and greened it with the ball looping around the green, very undulated, and stopping about 5 feet from the hole. Also that morning, I spent time doing video with Tony Manzoni giving a lesson. So he is going to be coming back onto the show again, and we will have some Golf Smarter TV to show too. Now, the other course that I played in Palm Desert was at the Westin Mission Hills. They have two courses, a Gary Player and then the one I played, the Pete Dye course. So in a couple of weeks, you're going to hear from their director of instruction talking about golf course design and how it's going to help your game when you understand it. Oh, I birdied the hole. But coming up next, the first of two conversations with Golf Digest's top two women teachers in America, Pia Nilsson and Lynn Marriott, on their latest book, Play Your Best Golf Now. If you have any comments, questions, or suggestions, please click on the Hey Fred button at golfsmarter.com.
Smarterpodcasts.com. Delivering sound advice.